You are listening to audio from Citizens Church in Annapolis, Maryland. I'm Pastor Joey, and I hope what you're about to hear blesses you, increases your love and knowledge of Jesus, and answers any questions that you might have about him.
Well, good morning, Citizens Church. I'm so glad to see all of you guys. My name is Joey. I'm one of the pastors here. I have the honor of typically bringing God's word to God's people on the Lord's Day, and so that is what we are doing. If you are new here, this is your first time with us, or if you haven't been here in a while, just to sort of recap what we're doing right now, what we're preaching on, what we're huddling around is, you know, as a church coming out of COVID and quarantine, as a church coming into a new space that we didn't have before, this new frontier is ahead of us, and I thought it would be wise and good that we all huddle ourselves around the thing that matters most, the thing that is our purpose, the reason why we exist. It's the reason why we're here. It's the reason for everything that ever happens, which is God's glory. Everything is all about God's glory. God is all about his own glory. And so we spent the first week talking about what it means for us to exist for God's glory, because God's glory, it's not like a bank account that increases or decreases. Like, God's glory is not contingent upon us. We don't change how glorious God is. So what does it mean to exist for God's glory? What we saw from John chapter 1 is what it means to exist for God's glory is to participate in God, to enjoy him, to walk with him, to fellowship with him. That's what it means to glorify God, is to revel and marvel in his glory, in his goodness, in who he is, and all of his infinite beauty and wonder. Last week, what did we talk about last week? I can't remember now. What did Pastor drove in? Exodus, thank you. Last week we talked about God's glory. And what do we mean by that? We tried to define it. And we looked at the characteristic of God that he exposes about himself, his true self, his innermost core of who he is, which is in Exodus 34. It's the most quoted, alluded to, referenced passage throughout the whole entire Old Testament. It's like the fundamental passage for the people of Israel. And what God reveals about himself in that scene with Moses is his glory, the essence of his being, is that he is abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, slow to anger, patient and forgiving, merciful and gracious and kind. Today, since we're talking about God's glory this week and next week, and by the way, just so you know, this is just like a tangential series. Usually we go through books of the Bible here, and so we will be jumping back into Proverbs in a few weeks from now. We started that before the pandemic. So that's what we do. We preach Old Testament, New Testament, back and forth here at Citizens Church. This is just sort of a temporary hold on that. We'll be back in Proverbs soon. But since we're talking about God's glory, I wanted to come with this message that I think it's life-changing. If we don't understand this reality that I want to unfold today, there are serious, life-altering, harmful consequences. See, if you choose not to exist according to your created purpose, the glory of God, you will suffer harmful, lifelong consequences. But if you choose to exist according to your created purpose, then you will flourish. There's a lot at stake depending on if we get this or not. And what I said there, you know, what you decide to live according to, what glory you decide to live according to, is going to dictate the trajectory of your life and who you become and your experience. That statement is thoroughly biblical. It's thoroughly biblical. I want to spend some time showing you that the biblical authors were aware of this reality, and they purposefully maintained a belief about worship. And here's what they believed about worship. Here's what they unfold for us. Here's what they state for us. You become what you worship. You and I become what we worship. The glory of God matters because if you choose to worship God, you will become like him. If you choose to worship another, you will be like it. So I want to walk through several passages as our introduction to lay this foundation to show you that this is a thoroughly biblical, theological concept, that we become what we worship. Start with me in Exodus 32. It's on the screen behind me. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go down, for your people, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have," this is an important phrase, "they have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. They have made for themselves a golden calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt.'" And the Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people." Have you ever wondered, and then that phrase, stiff-necked, it's repeated a number of times throughout the following passage. Have you ever wondered why God gives Israel this characteristic, this attribute, they're stiff-necked? Why did he come up with that? Where does that come from? Well, do you know what is stiff-necked? A cow. A cow is a stiff-necked animal. And when it says in verse 8 that they have turned aside quickly out of the way, that is meant to convey that phrase is used elsewhere, this golden, stupid cow. He's saying, you have become what you worshiped. You are a stiff-necked, unrestrained people. Psalm 115, read it to me. "Their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths but do not speak, eyes but do not see. They have ears but do not hear. They have noses but do not smell. They have hands but do not feel, feet but do not walk, and they do not make a sound in their throat. Those who make them become like them. So do all who trust in them." We become what we worship. These idols are lifeless. They have no breath. They're futile. They're vain. And God says here in Psalm 115 that you become like the very things that you worship. When you worship vain, lifeless, silly, foolish, empty things, that is what you become. Isaiah 4, "This is the ones who worship their idols, neither nor know, that they may be put to shame." Jeremiah 2:5. Thus says the Lord, "What wrong did your fathers find in me that they went far from me and went after worthlessness and became worthless?" 2 Kings 17. "They despised his God's statutes and his covenant that he made with their fathers and the warning he gave them. They went after false idols and became false. They followed the nations that were around them concerning whom the Lord had commanded them that they should not do like them." Over and over, and these are just a few selected verses, but over and over throughout the whole entire Old Testament narrative, there is this theological reality that you become like the very thing that you worship. And what we mean by that, becoming what we worship, is you take on that thing's traits. You absorb that thing's traits, or the power that is in the substance of that thing transforms you, for better or for worse, but in anything but God, always for worse, always dehumanizing, always lacking substance, always superficiality, always void, always empty. We become what we worship. We take on its traits. We are changed by its power. Now, to notice this in our own lives, if you want to detect this reality in you and in the world around you, there's an equation that you must know. It's the lens you put on to see this in yourself. And here's the equation: your lack plus your sought-out source equals your God. Your lack plus where you go to find solution is going to give evidence to what is your God. And what your God is going to determine who you are. So let me give you an example of this, just of this profound transformative reality from ancient Israel. You know, throughout the whole entire Old Testament, what is the constant refrain of God against Israel? That they worshiped other gods, that they devoted themselves to other idols. One of those idols, for example, that they chose was Baal. Baal was the god of fertility. He would send rain to produce crops, but he would only do that, he said, if you went to the cult or the places of the altars of worship around the region and you participated in cultic sexual immorality. If you did that, then Baal would send rain. And you might think to yourself, well, yeah, I mean, these Israelites always being so carnal, always being so sinful, of course that was appealing to them. Of course they went after that. That's gratifying to their sin, to why Baal was appealing to them. And here's what it is. In the ancient times, in the Eastern culture, if you don't have rain, you don't have crops. If you don't have crops, your family dies. So the promise of rain from a god in an expedient way, in an easy way, that's really appealing. It's not so much that they had this sexual appetite. That might be on the surface, but more fundamentally, there was something operating behind their worship. There was something pushing them to choose Baal as their god. Israel would do anything for themselves to guarantee security. So they found the least demanding god who would give them the most expedient solution so that their lack would be met. Fundamentally, then, Israel was not worshiping Baal. Baal was just a means to an end. Fundamentally, Israel was worshiping security. They worshiped security, so they chose Baal because he would give them some form of security and demand very little in return. And for it, what happened to Israel? How were they transformed? How were they conditioned? For it, they became sexually deviant and promiscuous, and they became conditioned to perform in order to acquire security. Therefore, they were rendered unable to trust or to have any sort of actual relationship with a god that they would need to depend on. So here's the equation: lack plus sought-out source equals your God. So it was Israel's lack of crops plus Baal's promised rain that reveals what? Security was their God. Now you might think that this example I'm using here is ancient. And of course, we don't do that in these modern, sophisticated times. Of course, we're not like that. We're not that superficial. We're not like that, right? Well, let me list out several examples from our lives, from our times, that show that we are no different than ancient Israel. Although that may have been a very antiquated model of worship, of becoming what you worship, is just as real, just as potent today. So here's the equation. Remember, lack plus sought-out source reveals what your God is. Keep that in mind as I read these all to you. You lack meaningful relationship. So you attach yourself to the first person who comes around. What that reveals is affirmation is your God. And that God will make you easily influenced, lack standards, and eventually compromise to get what you need. So the boyfriend, the girlfriend, the friend group that you attach yourself to, that's not your God. Affirmation is your God, and you attach yourself to that person, to that group, because they give you that thing immediately. Let's think about pornography. There's two reasons why someone watches pornography. First, you lack excitement. So you watch porn that reveals pleasure is your God. Or you feel like you lack reciprocation and feel snubbed, so you find a fantasy that is according to your liking or your sexual experience that you think you deserve. Therefore, respect and appreciation is your God. And look, that God will make you selfish, narcissistic, and isolated. You will always view women or men as objects for your pleasure and your self-appreciation. The porn is not your God. Pleasure and respect is your God, and you attach yourself to porn because it will give it to you immediately without any effort and relational sacrifice, because it's conditioned you to be like that. You lack compliments or trophies or praise or recognition. So you work tirelessly. You work and spend yourself. Therefore, approval is your God. And that God, approval, will make you unable to say no constantly, committing yourself to all these sorts of things. Burn approval is. And you use your work. You give yourself to your work because it's the quickest, most natural way to get that approval, to get access to that God. You lack the look, the car, the house. So you attach yourself to a lifestyle or a celebrity, and you spend money that you do or do not have in order to get that status. Therefore, image. Image is your God. Identity is your God. And that God, image and identity, if that is your narrowed focus, it will make you insecure, it will make you comparative, it will make you competitive, it will ultimately make you condescending because you have to put everybody down to keep yourself up. Clothes and cars, that's not the God. Image is, and you attach yourself to that celebrity look or that lifestyle. So what? You attach yourself to church and religion. What does that show? Moral superiority is your God. And that will make you what? Judgmental and hypocritical, living with tons of double standards. Church and religion is not your God. Moral superiority is, and you attach yourself to church. You manipulate church. You use religion to your advantage because it's the most controllable, manageable way to get that moral confidence. You lack peace. So you attach yourself to a substance or to a distraction. Relief, rest is your God. And that will make you shallow and superficial, unable to critically think, unable to concentrate. You're fragile and frazzled. Substance, distraction, that relief to manufacture for yourself that rest. Last one, you lack feeling important. So you attach yourself to every cause, every problem, every needy person, every drama relationship, because validation is your God. That God, validation, will make you live for others. It will make you need to be needed. It will make you depend upon drama, attracted to drama, magnetized to drama. The person, the problem, the cause is not your God. Validation is, and you attach yourself to whatever opportunity, to whatever agenda, to whatever need there is, because that is the quickest way to get validation on your own terms in your timing. And look, I haven't even talked about marriage and kids, all these fundamental things that we make our gods. So if you're here, and you need to identify and detect what you worship, who your false God is, ask yourself this question: what if I lost it forever? If it was eliminated from my life forever, would make life no longer worth living? And once you settle on that, once that sinks in, ask yourself why. Why is that? Why do I begin to feel such despair, anxiety, and sorrow when that one element, one person, one relationship, one experience is eliminated from my life? When it's gone, why do I feel like my life is falling out underneath me? It's because that thing is your God. Not the relationship, the equation, your lack plus your sought-out source equals reveals your God, proves this. That we manipulate things and people to get what we want. Those things, those gods change us, and they are never permanent. They never give us what we actually hope for. Our worship then depends upon us continually manipulating. Our gods demand our devotion, then overpromise, and then underdeliver. And look, if you're here and you're an unbeliever, This, friend, is the cycle that you're living in. You might think you're a morally good person, but consider what you worship. And consider what you have done or what you are capable of doing in order to keep that thing, get that thing that you worship. You will find, if you're honest with yourself, if you allow what is self-evident to be laid out before you, you will find that you are more dishonest, cunning and manipulative, judgmental and hypocritical, unjust and unfair, living with intolerance and double standards more than you would ever like to realize and acknowledge. And I'm not singling out unbelievers only, because Christians, we're really good at doing this too. Except we use religion or morality or church or the Bible to do these things for us. We baptize our false gods in religion, and then we justify it because we're not as bad as others. We justify it because we still worship God, so the scales are balanced. But look, what is apparently true is that we're all flawed in this way. So receive the fullness in a permanently, deeply abiding form of these things without making them gods. Because if we do, we will suffer life-altering, deteriorating side effects from them from here on out. And look, the good news is there is a way to get these fundamental things, but it requires adopting an entirely new equation. Before, your lack plus your sought-out solution reveals who your God is. Here's the new equation that you must memorize, that you must adopt, that you must believe and use. The equation is God through Christ alone, only, equals seek no more, lack no more. That's the equation you must believe. And where I want to show you this in 2 Corinthians 3, that this is what Paul believes. This is what Paul writes. This is what God instructs us to, the equation that God tells us to adopt. So go with me to verse 16, and we'll see first, God through Christ. Where do I get that from? Verse 16. But when one turns to the Lord, the veil is removed. See, the veil here that Paul talks about, it's a metaphor to communicate our spiritual blindness, our inability to want God, to love God, to reach out to God, to be interested in God. The veil means we are unable to be aware of not only God and have a concern for Him, but also means that we are unaware of our own flawed condition, of how under their sway, under their abuse, entranced in their by devotion to them, and we don't even know it. But when one turns to the Lord, the veil is lifted. Keep your face masks on. I'm not saying take them off, just so we're clear, okay? That veil remains on. But when the veil comes off when you turn to the Lord. What does that mean to turn to the Lord? What does it mean to turn to the Lord? It's very simple. It means to convert. Conversion. Convert to Christianity. Now, I know when you hear that, that word conversion might sound really fundamental and traditional. I know when you hear that, that sounds like a really tame, docile, and safe word, but it's not. Not in the least. Because if you were to ask a Muslim in Syria to convert to Christianity, what that requires a lifestyle in a community, in a culture sometimes, it means severing the tie completely. That's what converting means. Turning your back on everything that you once knew would give you those fundamental things. So, Christian, Unbeliever, listen, turn to the Lord. What that means is you leave behind those former gods, those false gods, those idols, those sources that you would go to receive that power, to receive that substance, to receive that counterfeit form of life. You separate ties with those things from here on out. And not only does it mean separating ties from those things and the sometimes often the means that you would manipulate, the things that you would leverage in order to get those things. Not only does it mean cut ties with those things, but it also means cut ties with that equation, the former equation that expediently. We could get it instantly. We could get it on our terms. We could get it according to our liking. We can get it in the timing that we prefer. And you know what? It cost us nothing. We chose for ourselves gods that would not contradict us, that would not tell us that we were wrong, that would only reinforce to us the things that we preferred and the things that we liked and the things that we loved. When you turn to the Lord, it means separating yourself from that way of thinking too, which means this: if you're going to turn to the Lord, He is not going to work expediently any longer. That's not going to work anymore. You're not going to get those fundamental things on your terms. You're not going to get those things in your timing that you would prefer. In fact, when you turn to the Lord, you're not turning to someone who's a doormat. You're not turning to someone who's just going to let you do whatever you want. You're turning into a relationship. He will no longer get behind your agenda. He will no longer reinforce the things that you held most dear and most prized over Him. When you turn to the Lord and only Him, it stops at Him. And so you separate yourself from false gods, from the former way of thinking. You separate yourself from those expectations that you once held, that this is how it's going to be for me to get those fundamental things that will no longer work. I was listening to a sermon this last week, and the preacher in the sermon told this story about this older lady in his church who was not a follower of Jesus, was not a Christian for the majority of her life. And when she turned to the Lord, what she realized is that all the relationships with men that she had been in, she was involved in these relationships, never able to separate herself with a man and his time and affection and presence and attention. After she became a Christian, after she converted, she started going to therapy, to Christian therapy, and here's what she told the pastor. She said, my Christian therapist said, you used to live for men and their attention and their affirmation because you had a self-worth issue. You know what you should do now to take care of that? You should get a career. That'll help. That'll benefit you. That'll make it easier for you to move on past that unhealthy habit in your life. And what this older woman realized is that, wait a second. She was wise enough, conscious enough to realize, wait a second. That's just replacing one counterfeit God with another. That's just replacing one empty, vain well that I drew water from with another. That won't work. And what that means, what that story communicates is it's very possible to hop from one source. Pay attention to what I'm going to say. It's very possible to do that very same thing with God. To turn to Him, to come to Him and manipulate Him, or at least try to. To try to strong arm Him, to try to use Him and leverage Him for happiness, for control, for a life that makes sense, for a different trajectory. That won't work because God is not a means to an end. And what that shows is that even still in your turning to the Lord, you're not doing it for Jesus. You're not doing it because you love God. You're doing it because there's something on the other side of Him. And He's a means to an end. Turn to the Lord for God and God alone, for what is in Him. What is in Him? Why do we turn to the Lord and Him alone? Unbeliever, if you're here and you're not a Christian, listen, this is of your devotion because He's worthy of your life, period. Here's why, because He is the Creator. Therefore, he has rightful ownership of you. He has claim over your life. And as long as you live apart from him, you are defying his claim on you, and you are living in hostile defiance towards his will, towards his design, towards his care for you, towards his claim over you. You turn to Jesus, unbeliever, because he outright deserves it. You are obligated to. He has rightful claim over you. And if that rubs you the wrong way, what that just shows is you've been conditioned by your idols and your false gods to want to worship according to a way that never rubs you the wrong way, that never tells you you can't be independent, that you can't have it your own way. That's not going to work with God. You don't just turn to God only because he's worthy. That's certainly true. You turn, unbeliever, to God because the worthy creator, the one who has every rightful claim over every single one of your breaths, also extravagantly loves you. He has demonstrated his love for you. The God who is worthy is also humble and kind, because the just wrath that you built up for yourself by defying his rightful claim on your life, Jesus absorbed every single bit of that just wrath so that you would not have to. The God who has every rightful claim on you has also demonstrated his extravagant love for you. You turn to God through Christ. Yes, because you're obligated. You will find no better person, no better being, no better source of these fundamental things than in the most strong yet tender, mighty yet humble, just yet loving creator. Believer, listen now here. You're not off the hook. Every day you turn to the Lord. Every day you turn to Jesus because he keeps you from drifting back into that former way of thinking. He protects you from drifting back towards all your counterfeit gods, towards all your vain things you worship, so that you never become vain yourself. If you don't turn to the Lord, apart from constantly turning to him, you will find yourself plugging the holes of those things. I subscribe to those things, yet you're in love and chasing after all these other counterfeit gods. You are settling for yourself a half-hearted Christianity, which is a Christianity just not worth doing in the first place. Because here's what's going to be happening. You're going to look back on your former life, the former way of things. You're going to look back at that life with fondness, wishing you can have the happiness, wishing you could have the instant gratification, wishing you could have those instant pleasures. But here's God telling you, you can't. Here's God telling you, you should restrain yourself. Obey. Be holy. Unless you give yourself wholly and totally to God and turn to him, then you will be torn between two worlds. Just go all in. Just go all in. Oftentimes, the opposite occurs when you commit yourself to the Lord. It's sometimes not happy. It's harder. It doesn't make things easier. You do it for him and him alone. Because he's worthy, because he's extravagantly loving, because he is the final say on these things. But when you turn to Christ, what you'll discover is that your seeking does end. No more needing a solution for the lack you feel. There's no more lack, no more seeking. You have everything you need in Jesus. Let's see that now. This part of the equation, seek no longer, lack no more. 17 and 18. Now the Lord is the Spirit. And where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. See, when Christ takes, is this what Jesus thinks, what Jesus desires, begins to become the way you think, and it begins to become the things that you desire. Your system's mainframe, your palate, right? Your instincts begin to change. They begin to align more closely with Jesus' instincts, with what he's passionate about, with what he desires, and with what he thinks. His law, right, his righteous decrees, his instruction. You know, before you're a Christian, those things sound like a buzzkill. Those things sound like a party pooper. But when you turn to the Lord, the veil's removed, the Spirit takes up residence in you. Do you know what happens? That external law, that moral instruction gets infused into you. It gets embedded into you so that the things that make God happy, the things that please him, begin to please you. Because your will finally at abundant source of life in you. See, before you were a Christian, before you turned to the Lord, you look outside of you. You look external to you, to a relationship, to a girl, to a boy, to organized religion, to a cause, to whatever it may be, to find that source that's going to meet that lack. You want to experience that fundamental thing that's driving you crazy. But when you are born again, when the veil is lifted and you are indwelt by the Holy Spirit, the abundant life of God is placed within you. You no longer need to look outside of you to find the things that you crave. God has put them inside of you already. I'm not saying look inside yourself and pull yourself up by our bootstraps and find the power within you to make it through life. Wrong. What I'm saying is because God has put his very presence in you, his abundant source of life. John, the Gospel of John says it's rivers of living. The Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. Why does this profound reality of God's indwelling Spirit in us make us free? Here's why. Freedom is being able to say no to all the things that we used to settle for before and be okay with it because we have found the better thing. Because God has given you new desires, new instincts, because God has given you the living rivers of water flowing out of you, the source of life that is his very self in you, you can say no and refrain from drifting back and going back to the former things that you used to go towards to find cheap, shallow pleasure and gratification. You can be freed and released from that bondage, from going from source to source to source to vain thing to vain thing to vain thing, because you have found the true thing, the real thing. Freedom is being able to say no and be okay with it. And because of this freedom, the search is over. The cycle is broken. No more seeking vain things and becoming vain ourselves. We can now become what we worship, and it's a glorious thing. Verse 18. And we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. Now with our false gods eliminated and the true and living God revealed to us through Christ by the Spirit, we can behold the glory of God and be transformed into the very same image and likeness. Jesus is the perfect image of God. If you want to know who God is, you look no further than Jesus. If you want to know how good and satisfying and when I look at Jesus, I'm astounded at him. Because here's Jesus. Being God, yet okay being a carpenter. The most content, yet generous person. The most loving, yet just person. The most humble, yet confident person. That is Jesus. Look at Jesus' life. Jesus was single all his life. Never had a relationship, a romantic relationship, never had sex. Where does Jesus find that kind of contentment? How does Jesus have that kind of wholeness that he doesn't need a companion? Where does he get that from? It's because as he walked in the power of the Spirit and fellowship with the Father, everything he had in his relationship with God the Father filled him up completely. He needed nothing external to himself. He had everything he needed in his relationship with God. Unjustly, yet he takes it. Doesn't complain. He doesn't, out of a sense of ego, try to vindicate himself and justify himself. He walks forward to the cross for the joy set before him. And when he's on the cross with his dying breath, he shouts, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Into your hands I commend my spirit. Why have you forsaken me?" He grants forgiveness, prays for his enemies, and then declares Psalm 22, which is his statement of confidence that God will resurrect him, that he will be vindicated. His very last moments, dying a criminal's death that he did not deserve, he expresses, yet even in that unjust, terrible situation, his undying confidence in God. Here's what I'm trying to say. Whatever Jesus has, I want. Become what we worship. Jesus is the image of the immutable, unseen God. The fundamental things you crave, the person you want to be, you can now begin to become by worshiping him. And here's what I want to close with. Here's where we land. Here's how we conclude. What do we do? What step do we take now as a church? You individually, what are you supposed to do now? Here's what I recommend. Just worship him. Just worship Jesus. Just be fixated upon him. Be devoted to the word. Hit your knees in prayer. Become a member of this church. Devote yourself wholly to God in worship and leave the results to him. Let him take care of who you become. Let him take care of you becoming what you worship. You just worship him. And sometimes the best way that you used to go to begin to allow you to walk into situations and circumstances which show you that those things are never going to do it for you. As you experience that heartache, as you experience that frustration, that sanctifying, refining process where he's tearing you at the seam, it seems, making you a new person, lean into it. Lean into it. Don't tap out. Don't complain. Don't grumble and become bitter. God, why are you doing this? Don't victimize yourself. No, understand that God loves you so much that he wants you to worship something better so you become something better. He's going to take away everything in the way then. It's an act of love. Lean into it. Worship him. Leave the results to him. Become what you worship.
For more information about Citizens Church, please go to citizensannapolis.com.